The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and Lit Hub Radio.
It is not giving people who are headed to college a real good sense of what they can gain from literature.
It's almost like a list for people who don't like to read.
Hello, I'm Jack Wilson. Part two of our search for the greatest books ever, today on The History of Literature. Okay, here we go. This is part two of our look at the list of 101 books recommended for college-bound readers. This one we're going to do a little bit differently. I'm going to give you the rest of the list, numbers 51 through 101. I'll be joined by Mike, the president of the Literature Supporters Club, to walk through the list. Once again, we will talk about the ones we would remove, books that were left out. But then I'm going to cut off the conversation. We started to look at the nonfiction books that they added, and I grew angrier and angrier. I was exasperated by this list. I can't remember which book it was that set me off. It might have been Aesop's Fables. Might have been John F. Kennedy's Profiles in Courage. Or, actually, let me check the list here. The Education of Henry Adams. That might have put me over the edge. I don't remember now. Why do I care? Why do I care so much about the books that are recommended by the College Board? Look, if I have a religion, it's books. It's the closest thing I have to a religion. I believe, or I want to believe, in the importance of great books for what they show about humans, for what they show about humanity. And when I hear teachers, teaching is not easy, people, I understand that. I've taught for many years myself, whether it's English or history or philosophy or math or whatever. Whatever you're talking about, when I hear that teachers haven't engaged their students, it makes me struggle. I struggle to hold my tongue when I hear students say they hate English, and I ask why, and they say, well, we spent 3 months diagramming sentences. I was bored. Diagramming sentences, turn off. Tune out. I know there's room for grammar. It's an important building block. It's essential. I think it should be included whenever students need it. Should include grammar. But there's so much more to literature, to English. I saw something like this when I was teaching in Taiwan. Students there, I taught a lot of students who were immersed in cram schools, memorizing facts, learning things under a lot of pressure. They would have hours of study. Certain years in their educational system, years when they were getting ready to apply for and be admitted into the next level of school, they would be under a lot of pressure to get ready for these standardized tests. I know these are systemic issues. The pressure, parents are just doing their best. They don't mean to put all this kind of pressure on their kids, but it's hard to resist when that's your avenue for advancement. And the kids were doing their best, and a lot of them were burning out. So I was brought in to help them with their English. English was a little bit different. I didn't have an agenda. They had a regular English teacher for that. They had a curriculum. I was brought in to help with the culture, the accent, learning English from a native speaker. So we could talk about stories or ideas, as long as we were talking in English. We would have poems to read, short stories, movies, television shows we could talk about, things like that. The kids could write, and their creativity was unleashed. Not just creative writing, creativity. They could think about things and talk about them. I can remember one student, this was actually a teacher. We read Dylan Thomas's Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night. It was part of an anthology that she was working her way through. And she was just overwhelmed, overcome by emotion. We talked about it. Her own father was dying of cancer. She was reading that poem and thinking about the way she felt about her father, hoping that he wouldn't give up, worried when she saw signs that he was giving up. That's what literature for me can do at its best. Here's Dylan Thomas. Here's Sylvia Plath. What do you make of this? How does it stretch you? Does it provide comfort? Does it challenge you? Does it make you think differently? Does it make you live differently? So I hear a student say, I hate math. All we did is memorize multiplication tables. Okay. It's a third grader I'm talking to. All math is memorizing multiplication tables. Okay. I get it. That has to be learned. It's a building block. But how about making the math sparkle a little for these kids? So, here comes the College Board, an influential organization. They are in charge of the standardized tests. Everybody knows it. Teachers, high school teachers who care about how their students do have to take that into consideration. When they put together tests, there are essays on the test. The essays draw from the books that the College Board deems important. Getting ready for college. This is what the College Board is all about. Getting ready for college. It's on their website. Here's how to get ready for college. Here's one thing you can do. Read books on this list. Students all over the world who are planning to study in America, look to the College Board to find out what they should read, how they can improve themselves, how they can get ready for college, to make sure college, which is very expensive, how can they get the most out of the college experience? And this list, such an old and tired list. It's really frustrating. It's not there to engage people's minds or get them thinking. It's to check off a box or two or 50. Know this author, know these characters, know some dates where, when this or that book was written. Like I said, all that's important. There's a role for that, but it's so shallow. Where does that get us as a society? Literature is just another skill, useful to pass a test, then set it aside. No actual use for it. Just something you cram for and get through. Okay, so let's go through the list. We'll listen to the discussion about the books. Maybe you'll agree with our choices. Maybe not. Maybe you'll have your own. Maybe you'll be railing against us in your mind, or while you're running on your exercise equipment or on your daily commute. Be shouting at the wall. You'll be as angry at us as I was at the College Board. Maybe we cross off one of your favorites. My apologies in advance. In any case, I'll be back with some more ideas at the end, instead of our long discussion on how the College Board has failed. I'll have something optimistic, because I have some ideas about how we can solve this. We can solve this whole mess. I can hear what you're thinking. Who are you to solve this mess when the College Board is a panel of distinguished people who all got together, apparently in 1980, to put together this list? And they now have a panel of very distinguished people who have decided the list does not need to be adjusted in any way. Who are you, Jack Wilson? Well, I address that too. Don't worry. I'm not replacing this list with a list of my own. I'm not that arrogant to think that I can second guess the College Board, but I do have some ideas. Stay tuned. We are going to fix this mess. Hello, everyone. This is Jack here to tell you about a way to eat better and easier. That's right, Factor, and their delicious, ready-to-eat meals. These things are amazing, chef-crafted, always fresh, never frozen. All you do is heat them up and you're ready to go. No prepping, cooking, or cleanup, and you get something healthy, nutritious, and tasty. I love Factor meals, especially on those days when I'm in the office. They're better for me than snacks or junk food, and much cheaper and faster than buying my lunch at a restaurant. You can choose options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, and you can change your schedule to get as much or as little as you need every week, whatever suits you and your family best. Head to factormeals.com/literature50 and use code literature50 to get 50% off. That's code literature50 at factormeals.com/literature50 to get 50% off. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Okay, welcome again, Mike, to part two of the College Board's list of 101 great books recommended for college-bound readers.
I feel like I never left.
So, we have had a couple of days to think about this list and our amendments to the list. We've crossed off a bunch of things, and I can tick through some of the key highlights, but I just wanted to say that I've had some second thoughts. I started out with the second thoughts of feeling like there were just some, I was committing some sort of sacrilege by crossing some of these people off. We gave Chaucer a hard time last time, and Daniel Defoe and Dreiser, and we knocked off a Faulkner, and we did all of these, we did a lot of damage to these big names. But then I had third thoughts, and I looked at the people we added, like Borges and Carver and Chekhov's short stories and Emily Dickinson and Jack Kerouac and Tony Kushner and T.S. Eliot and all these people, and I just thought, I think this list really is missing something very essential about literature, that literature for me is about empathy and expansion, and The Canterbury Tales is almost like a history lesson, and it is not giving people who are headed to college a real good sense of what they can gain from literature.
Yeah, I'm in agreement. I think, you know, it's almost like a list for people who don't like to read.
Yeah, right. Or people who suffered through things when they were in school, and so they think that must be what everyone needs to suffer through. And it really needs updating. There's people that we crossed off, like James Agee, who he was probably a great pick in 1975, but he's just someone who has faded with time, and he should be replaced by a Junot Diaz or Italo Calvino or somebody who's just a little more, you know, Isabel Allende, Sandra Cisneros, Paul Auster, Billy Collins, all these people we talked about last time, Edward P. Jones, that somebody who can give people a sense that literature is something that's living and breathing, and that there are authors who are contemporaries or who have come out with books in this century that can be meaningful and can speak to people today.
I think it's a hard task. I think that's why...
that's what we're here for.
when 100 books... when you select 100 books, that's why I was thinking maybe we should just rank 500 books for people. The okay. way ESPN counts down like the top 500 players of all time.
Let's get onto the list. We've made it all the way through K last time. We're going to start. The first batch I want to do is L through M. And this is really, I can feel you sharpening up your, sharpening up your knives over there. Yeah. So let me read the names first. Harper Lee, To Kill a Mockingbird, Sinclair Lewis, Babbitt, Jack London, The Call of the Wild, Tomas Mann, The Magic Mountain, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, 100 Years of Solitude, Herman Melville, Bartleby the Scrivener, Herman Melville, Moby Dick, Arthur Miller, The Crucible, Toni Morrison, Beloved. So, what are you keeping from that list?
All right, so I can't believe they have The Call of the Wild instead of White Fang, which probably encapsulates, you know, my view of literature, which is White Fang is an exciting, you know, extreme narrative, a very violent narrative. And the morality is far more interesting than The Call of the Wild.
Yeah. Well, look what they did with morality here. I mean, there's the person we can add. They have no ends on the list, but we can add Nabokov, Lolita. I don't know why they shied away from that one. They have Henry Roth on here instead of Philip Roth, which, you know, fine. Henry Roth he wrote a book that had its little day in the sun, but you can only think that they left Philip Roth out because they had moral concerns. I think they, you know, they had a lot of very safe picks on here.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely keep Magic Mountain and Moby Dick, of course, but like Bartleby the Scrivener, I think it's, I read somewhere that it makes a great tote bag.
Yeah.
You know, it's very symbolic, but is it, you know, a story that everyone needs to read? I'd be hard pressed to vote for that.
Right. It's a little slight.
Yeah.
And when you think about the L's and M's who are not on here, Alice Munro would be a very good choice. Murakami would be another one. I mentioned Nabokov already. I would even have Jhumpa Lahiri, I think you could put on this list. Cormac McCarthy is another one. Mario Vargas Llosa, Doris Lessing, Ian McEwan, Laurie Moore, our guy Javier Marias, who I'm going to get that episode up soon. Primo Levi. I don't think they have any Holocaust survivor books on here.
Yeah, The Periodic Table is a beautiful book by Levy. And you know that, and you know, talking about variety as we did in the last podcast, that book within its a single text has such variety. I mean, it's such, you know, the degrees of nostalgia and the degrees of guilt having survived. And I mean, I guess that's one thing, you know, when, since we talked about the last time we talked, is the more I think of this list and the more, like you said, there are a lot of safe picks. They shied away from the complexity of, you know, not only morals, but just character. Mm-hmm. You know, it's almost like these books, some of these books are really ready made for discussion.
Yeah. Sinclair Lewis, Babbitt. I mean, come on. That's like, there's, you know, it's like the course I talked about last time of 18th century novels. Okay, you take a course like that, that's where you read Samuel Richardson and Fielding, Henry Fielding, and authors like that. Sinclair Lewis should be in a course that you take, a specialized course that's something like American novels in between the world wars, you know, something like that. It does not need to be on the 101 list of recommendations when you're keeping people like Murakami out.
Yeah, I mean, I love, I think Norwegian Wood and Wind Up Bird Chronicle are two amazing novels. And especially Norwegian Wood is an incredible young person's novel about high school and college and so entertaining. I mean, that's the thing is,
right?
When I read a long book, I think one of the things that keeps me going is the sensibility, and often there's humor, but there can be a unique sensibility without humor too.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Moby Dick for me has that. 100 Years of Solitude has that. So I don't want to, you know, really crap on this list. But like The Crucible, like, I mean, I can't imagine anyone saying anything intelligent about The Crucible that hasn't already been said.
Yeah. And there's so few plays on here, and all of them are from the 50s or earlier. It just seems like a waste. I'll keep Beloved, of course.
Me too.
You know, I know The Magic Mountain, I hate to say this. I would maybe swap that out with Death in Venice if we're going to have Tomas Mann, but I know that's...
Oh, that's crazy. That's crazy talk.
I know that's your guy. Harper Lee is in that category. To Kill a Mockingbird is in that category we talked about before of books that people really probably will encounter in high school, and maybe they need to be on there just to make sure that everybody's caught up with everybody else. But I don't know. Let's move on to the next batch. Flannery O'Connor, A Good Man is Hard to Find, which I assume that's a collection of stories, not just the story. Eugene O'Neill, Long Day's Journey into Night. George Orwell, Animal Farm. Boris Pasternak, Dr. Zhivago. Sylvia Plath, The Bell Jar. Edgar Allan Poe, Selected Tales. Marcel Proust, Swan's Way. Thomas Pynchon, The Crying of Lot 49. Eric Maria Remarque, I don't know how to pronounce that, All Quiet on the Western Front. And Edmund Rostand, Cyrano de Bergerac. I mean...
Some of these selections really did make me laugh. I mean, you know, it's almost like they were looking at other lists and noticed people who had continued to select these books. So they thought, well, we might as well have it on our list.
Yeah, I think so. Or I remember when I was a kid, I had this series of books called Great Illustrated Classics. And they were all of these books from it was probably a copyright thing where they just chose a lot of Dickens and a lot of books that they didn't have to pay copyright on. But Edmund Rostand, Cyrano de Bergerac, I don't even think that made that list. I don't know why that's on here. Boris Pasternak, Dr. Zhivago. This is a list that does not have Anna Karenina, but it's got Dr. Zhivago. It just feels dated. It's a Cold War. such a Cold War book. Eugene O'Neill, I think, could go.
I would take Proust off the list because I just don't think many 18-year-olds are ready for Proust.
That's probably right. And it's not something people are going to expect you to have read. And it's just Swan's Way. It's not even the entire book. So it's almost like you might as well go back to what we were talking about before. Just have a list of books to skim or just to know who the authors are and generally what they're about. I remember somebody saying that to me once about Balzac and Stendhal. They said, you know, I've never read them, but I know what they are. I know who they are. And you know, maybe for entering college, that's a good enough level of understanding.
I did want to say, though, that, you know, whenever I look at these lists, I always think of when I first go to a dinner party or go over to a newly made friend's the house of a friend I've just made and scan their bookshelves. And when I notice all of Proust, there are a host of assumptions I make. And when I notice, when I see, like, you know, Paradise Lost by Milton or something like that. Mm-hmm. Because I expect to see I like the Bell Jar a lot, and I would keep that. I think that's an important book, and it's also, I love her poetry. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I kind of expect it to be on the shelf. And so it's interesting, you know, in my memory of the friends I have, certain books really kind of pop out. Mm-hmm. And so Proust is one of them. I will say I really like the pick, The Crying of Lot 49, because that book is unlike a lot of books on this list.
Yeah, that's true. I have it as something that is not essential reading because I think of Pynchon as being another one who is fading a bit with time. I think we've absorbed him in a way, but I agree with you that in the context of this list, that's one that stands out as a less safe choice and something that's actually kind of interesting.
And it has the funniest lawyer in literature.
Wait. I think maybe it's number two after Lionel Hutz from The Simpsons.
I thought you were going to bring up William Gaddis's Frolic of One's Own.
Nope, it's Hutz all the way.
I mean, and we talked about this last episode, you know, Animal Farm, again, it's a fascinating book when you read it when you're 13, but mm-hmm. I mean, the collection of essays, that's outstanding. I mean, his collection is so good.
And especially the essay Politics in the English Language one that college students, you know, they should probably just hand that out at orientation week.
Yeah. And I, you know, and that speaks to another point, which is I think there's a lot to be learned by reading British authors. And I'm an Anglophile, so maybe I'm biased, but I think the Brits, their use of language is more precise. Mm-hmm. And it's also more strategic. Like they dip into modes, linguistic modes, far more than American writers. I think I think when you read Orwell's essays, you're just so struck by the precision of the language.
Yep. Okay. So the interesting thing about this batch is, although I found a lot. Plenty to cross off of the, I guess it's O through R. Mm-hmm. I did not really come up with a lot of names that I would necessarily swap in. So we don't have to spend too much time on it, but I don't know that I would add Joyce Carol Oates, for example, or I had Grace Paley, Orhan Pamuk, who I've never read, but I know Snow has a lot of fans that maybe it's something, if I read it, I would think it deserved being added to the list.
No, no Anthony Powell?
Oh, Anthony Powell. Nope. I could leave him. I could leave him out.
I would vote for Goodbye Columbus. I have a sweet spot for that book. I've read it a couple times, and I think for an 18-year-old, it's a pretty cool collection of stories.
Yep. And that's getting us into the next batch, because Henry Roth is the first one on the next one. But definitely it seemed very strange to me that given this list and given when they compiled it, it seemed like a real conscious omission to leave off Philip Roth, even though he's not one of my favorite authors or anything. But it did feel like they were taking a position. So let me go through the next batch. This is R through the first half of S. Henry Roth, Call It Sleep, J.D. Salinger, The Catcher in the Rye, William Shakespeare, and he's got four titles on here, Hamlet, Macbeth, A Midsummer Night's Dream, and Romeo and Juliet, George Bernard Shaw, Pygmalion, Mary Shelley, Frankenstein, Leslie Marmon Silko, Ceremony, and Alexander Solzhenitsyn, One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich.
I would strike up Pygmalion. That to me, that's another one of those one joke,
yeah,
one line jokes.
Who? I mean, are they even putting on Shaw plays now? Like, it just,
yeah.
He's a historical curiosity, I think. There is a good group of names in this range that could be added. In addition to Philip Roth, there's Marilyn Robinson, there's Salman Rushdie. I think Midnight's Children is probably something that should be on this list. There's W.G. Sebald, there's Jose Saramago. Zadie Smith would be a nice inclusion here. And I would probably add Stendhal.
Oh, yeah.
So there's plenty we could add. Shakespeare is interesting. I mean, you could have sort of the collected works of William Shakespeare, and it would probably all... pretty much, you know, there's probably 10 or 12 plays that could really go on this list. The sonnets could also be included. But if they're picking four, I guess, you know, these four are as good as any. I'm not a huge fan of A Midsummer Night's Dream, but that may be just me and my personal taste. Hamlet and Macbeth would be on my list. Romeo and Juliet probably would be.
I thought they should replace Midsummer Night's Dream with Twelfth Night. I think Twelfth Night is, you know, you get a lot of that playfulness, but you get the cross-dressing, which is a fairly common theme with Shakespeare, and also the fact that all the actors were men playing women, so you had a man playing a woman who was pretending to be a man.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Twelfth Night is a fantastic play.
Yeah, and they left out Othello and Lear are kind of the two major omissions. You know, there's just a lot that you...
you left out the Henry the Fourth, Henry the Fifth.
Yeah, and the Tempest. I mean, it's... I guess they can only do so much.
Yeah.
But it's weird to see, you know, four plays by Shakespeare, and you start thinking about all the plays that they're leaving out, and then to see the next one, George Bernard Shaw, Pygmalion, and you just think, come on, does that really belong on this list?
Right.
Yeah, okay.
I like to pick like Catcher in the Rye. I think, you know, you should have read it by 18, but if you haven't, I think it's, you know, it's an age appropriate pick.
Yeah, and Mary Shelley, same thing. You know, worth reading. I think Solzhenitsyn for me is kind of going the way of Pasternak, where although I acknowledge that it's a powerful book, it kind of strikes me as being kind of a Cold War book, and maybe the Cold War is dissolving in importance.
Yeah.
Okay, next batch. Sophocles, Antigone, Sophocles, Oedipus Rex. Is that two of the three trilogy?
Yeah.
Yeah, so they just left out the third one. Yeah. John Steinbeck, The Grapes of Wrath, Robert Louis Stevenson, Treasure Island, Harriet Beecher Stowe, Uncle Tom's Cabin, Jonathan Swift, Gulliver's Travels, William Thackeray, Vanity Fair, Henry David Thoreau, Walden, Leo Tolstoy, War and Peace, and Ivan Turgenev, Fathers and Sons. This is another batch that I'm just getting more and more incensed the farther along we go here.
I mean, Gulliver's Travels, like, yeah. I mean, are we going to put Winnie the Pooh on this? I mean, it's like,
I think, you know who's not on here is Lewis Carroll. That is a little surprising when I think about it. Yeah, Gulliver's Travels, it's true. You know, you could hand out a comic book of the story if you think the story needs to be told.
Right.
Jonathan Swift, if anything, if a college student needs to know anything of Jonathan Swift, it's probably A Modest Proposal. That gets referred to here and there, and that's kind of a fun and easy read. I just don't think Gulliver's Travels or Uncle Tom's Cabin or Vanity Fair or Fathers and Sons or Treasure Island or The Grapes of Wrath really need to be read by a college-bound reader.
Yeah, I mean, it's... All right, Antigone, I think, is... Antigone is the one where the woman has her brother betrays her city, and they won't allow a proper burial. Is that?
Yeah.
Okay. So I just read that a couple of years ago, and I loved it.
Yeah.
So it's another vote. Another positive is that it's very short. I read it in a day. So
right.
I would vote for that. But I'm in agreement with you here. It's almost like they needed to pick a couple of books from S&T, letters S&T, and just plucked a few here.
We've already mentioned Zadie Smith and Stendhal. Yeah. They could have chosen.
And Saramago's Blindness. I thought that was just an incredible book. And, you know, kind of tied into a lot of the popularity of Apocalypse, mm-hmm. and, you know, dystopian TV shows and, you know, movies. Yeah, if people haven't read that book, I really recommended it. There's kind of a spread of blindness throughout the city, and what happens, kind of like what happens in The Walking Dead, is that little societies form. Every society is built, it is structured on power, except for like a couple, and those are immediately, like, you know, preyed upon by the power societies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all so descriptive because it's all told in the, you know, they're all blind, so people are just groping. And then, without revealing too much, it turns out that somebody is not blind.
Right.
Oh, it's so good.
And he's, you know, he won the Nobel Prize. I mean, I think we have enough distance, enough critical distance to say that he's somebody who has stood the test of time and could easily go on a list of books that one would recommend to a college-bound reader.
Yeah.
You know, War and Peace, you could also have Anna Karenina on there. I guess, you know, 700 pages of Tolstoy is enough to give you a flavor of what he's about, but I would say that both of those two books are more important than, at this point, Uncle Tom's Cabin or Vanity Fair. Okay, final batch. Mark Twain, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, Voltaire, Candide, Kurt Vonnegut Jr., Slaughterhouse-Five, Alice Walker, The Color Purple, Edith Wharton, The House of Mirth, Eudora Welty, Collected Stories, Walt Whitman, Leaves of Grass, Oscar Wilde, The Picture of Dorian Gray, Tennessee Williams, The Glass Menagerie, Virginia Woolf, To the Lighthouse, and Richard Wright, Native Son.
To the Lighthouse is one of my favorite books, so I was very happy to see this on the list.
Yeah, you could. I also wrote down Mrs. Dalloway. You could add here and the essay A Room of One's Own.
Mrs. Dalloway is such a trip, though. Reading that can really. I think she took stream of consciousness to a new level with Mrs. Dalloway. My markings in that book are pretty funny. And, you know, Leaves of Grass is an essential book. But the rest of this list, I could really take it or leave it.
Ouch. That's the president of the Literature Supporters Club, to Taking a look at the College Board's list of the 101 recommended books for college readers and saying he could take it or leave it. But you see what the problem is? We have selection issues. Here's a list that the College Board put together. Looks like a list from the mainly from the 1950s. People who came of age in the 1950s. They took control of the reins, took over the reins in the 1970s, put together this list. As far as I can tell, the last time this has been updated was probably 1985. There's a few half-hearted attempts to diversify the list, which are much appreciated, but woefully inadequate. It's not a list that's going to speak to people. But then again, you see what the problem is? Who am I? For that matter, who's Mike? The two of us are just two more voices. What do we know? Why are we better? It's just two votes. So, thankfully, there's a solution. And there's a man, Shane Sherman. I know nothing about him. He's my hero for the day. He's already getting started on this. He has a different approach. I found this at the site greatestbooks.org. It's a wonderful way of thinking about this. In the internet age, it's kind of like the, if you're familiar, those of you who follow American politics might be familiar with the website 538.com, Nate Silver's site. What he does is, he doesn't take a poll, just another poll. Every poll has assumptions. They all ask different questions. They all reach different people. They all have different methodologies. There's a lot of assumptions that go into a poll. In our current climate, the assumptions might be, do you include people who have cell phones? Or are you just calling people's home phones? And do you include third-party candidates when you're asking people's preferences? Do you ask people if they're a registered voter and which party they're affiliated with, or do you just ask them which party do they identify with? You can get slightly different results based on all of these different choices and assumptions. It's not that dissimilar from the different choices or assumptions that Mike or I would make, or that the College Board made. Do you value books that are more recent, or do you value books that stood the test of time? Do you look for diversity? Do you try to round out the list? Do you value those things more heavily because you're trying to build a list that's more reflective of the general population, that will speak to people of all different backgrounds? What? How do you weight this? How do you choose? How do you select? Nate Silver says, well, we're not going to conduct a poll and assume that we can come up with all the perfect assumptions. We're going to combine all of the polls. We're going to use a methodology that will weight state polls more heavily than national polls. We have to make some assumptions there, but our research is going to be to put together a poll of polls. That's what Shane Sherman is getting at with his greatestbooks.org site. He has 107 lists of the greatest books of all time. And he's feeding them all into an algorithm. And he is transparent with his methodology. That's important. So you can take a look at the list that he's included. I think he's willing to include any list that seems credible. And the lists are very diverse in their approach. The top 100 works in world literature chosen by the Norwegian book clubs. That's in here. Or the 110 best books. The Perfect Library, which was put together by The Telegraph, the British newspaper. Or Harold Bloom, How to Read and Why. He had a list. Thomas C. Foster, How to Read Literature Like a Professor. Martin Seymour Smith, the 100 most influential books ever written. Those are by individuals, but they're in here too. The 100 greatest novels of all time by The Observer. It goes on and on. 50 books that changed the world. Believer magazine, Donald Barthelme's reading list. 100 best books in the world chosen by Abe Books, a German website. Or The Millions, an American website, chose the best fiction of the millennium. All of these lists, it goes on and on. And he gives some of them less weighting and more weighting. If it's only done by a single individual, he takes off a few points. If it's limited to 25 or less years, he takes off some more points. He has 22 different criteria. It's all listed. You can argue, or you could question his choices, but they're there for you to look at. It's not a black box like the College Board is. I really like this approach. And if you were trying to find books recommended for College Bound readers, maybe you would include a survey of syllabi, or you would weight more heavily books by lists by college professors. Wouldn't that make sense? Wouldn't that make sense? Here's the list. The 50 books everyone needs to read. That's in here. He also includes books that have won awards, National Books Book Critic Circle Award, National Book Awards, Pulitzer Prize. They all make their way into this algorithm. Let's see what the results are like. Here's my idea. You can also break this down by decade. It's a very interesting website. You can break this down by decade. So here's my idea. Since the College Board seems to have stopped their selections at 1985, I thought, well, what if we were to take 20 books that were written this century? Just start there. 20 books written in the 2000s. And maybe another 10 written in the 90s. And then maybe 70 that were the greatest of all time. How about that? Would that be, and we use this compendium of lists, this list of lists, this mega list. Would we come up with a better list of 100 just by doing that? And this is without even tweaking Shane Sherman's methodology, looking for books for college-bound readers. This is just using his methodology to find the greatest books of all time. Here's what we'd come up with. Here are the 70 books that we would come up with as the greatest books of all time. I won't read the entire list. I'll just start out. You stop me when you think I've named an inessential book. In Search of Lost Time, Marcel Proust. That's number one. All those lists churning away, all those selections, all those people thinking, they're all generating their lists. And that's what surfaced as number one. Number two, Ulysses by James Joyce. Number three, Don Quixote by Miguel de Cervantes. Number four, Moby Dick by Herman Melville. Five, Hamlet, William Shakespeare. Six, War and Peace by Leo Tolstoy. Seven, The Odyssey by Homer. Eight, The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald. Nine, The Divine Comedy by Dante Alighieri. 10, Madame Bovary by Gustave Flaubert. 11, Brothers Karamazov by Fyodor Dostoevsky. 12, 100 Years of Solitude, Gabriel Garcia Marquez. 13, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain. 14, The Iliad by Homer. 15, Lolita by Vladimir Nabokov. 16, Anna Karenina by Leo Tolstoy. You can hear there's already books, essential books, that were not on the College Board's list. 17, Crime and Punishment. 18, Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. 19, The Sound and the Fury. 20, Pride and Prejudice, Jane Austen. 21, The Catcher in the Rye. 22, Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte. 23, 1984 by George Orwell. 24, Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad. And 25, To the Lighthouse by Virginia Woolf. 25. I don't have a single book there that I could cross off. Every one of them. Something is going right with Mr. Sherman's list of lists. And if I look at the rest of the 70, I see Middlemarch, I see The Trial, I see Chekhov's Stories, I see Stendhal, I see The Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison, Great Expectations, Beloved, Borges's Collected Fiction, Midnight's Children, all those books that we thought probably deserved a spot are here. They made their way onto this list through this process. All these people around the world, he includes lists by French newspapers, Spanish newspapers, Argentinian authors choosing their favorite books. It's incredible. How do we do with books from the 2000s? Number one, The Corrections by Jonathan Franzen. Now, a lot of you probably know, if you've been listening to the podcast, I have my issues with Mr. Franzen. However, I will acknowledge that he is someone to be reckoned with if you are recommending books for people to read to get them ready for college. I can see where he needs to be on the list. Austerlitz by W.G. Sebald. The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay by Michael Chabon. That's number three. Atonement by Ian McEwan. Cloud Atlas by David Mitchell. 2666 by Roberto Bolaño. 7. The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde by Juno Diaz. 8. Middlesex by Jeffrey Eugenides. 9. White Teeth by Zadie Smith. And 10. The Road by Cormac McCarthy. It goes on. Once again, remember I'm taking 20 here, just from this millennium. 20 to add to my list for college-bound readers. And I get Margaret Atwood. I get Lydia Davis. I get a graphic novel, Jimmy Corrigan, The Smartest Kid on Earth by Chris Ware. I get Edward P. Jones. I get Derek Walcott, Marilyn Robinson, The Life of Pi by Jan Martel. I get Orhan Pamuk, Kazuo Ishiguro. Then if I take my 10 from the 90s, I get American Pastoral by Philip Roth, The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle by Haruki Murakami, Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone by J.K. Rowling, Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace, Selected Stories of Alice Munro, The Things They Carried by Tim O'Brien, Jesus's Son by Dennis Johnson, these Jazz by Toni Morrison, these... I'm getting angry again. Because what do we lose if we do this? That's my new 100. It's this list of lists. What would we lose? All Quiet on the Western Front, A Death in the Family, The Last of the Mohicans, Dreiser's American Tragedy, Pygmalion by George Bernard Shaw. 20 others like this, crossed off. Easily crossed off. We're not going to miss The Last of the Mohicans. people are better off reading Haruki Murakami. I believe that. I know people, he's their favorite author. Is there anyone who would say that James Fenimore Cooper is his or her favorite author? Maybe. Maybe a couple of English major people who are deep into it. But is there anybody who would pick up that book and feel like my student felt in Taiwan, the one who was overcome when she read Dylan Thomas's poem? Would anyone feel that way reading The Last of the Mohicans? Feel like it would resonate with them in some way? Engage them? Oh, man, I know. Wisconsin Happy Boy. Where's Wisconsin Happy Boy? Well, maybe he could return if the College Board would scrap their list. Why don't they hire Shane Sherman? He could show them a better way. Okay, I think that's going to do it for this time. I'm Jack Wilson. Thank you for listening. As always, it's appreciated. You can find more at jackwilson.com, J-A-C-K-E, wilson.com, or historyofliterature.com. We're also rolling with our new Facebook page. It's facebook.com/historyofliterature. You can like our page and keep up with all the news that way. Or you can subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts. While you're there, you could leave us a 5-star rating or a review, or you could send me an email at jackwilsonauthor@gmail.com. Once again, that's J-A-C-K-E, wilsonauthor@gmail.com. I love to hear from you. Maybe you've got your own ideas about which books should be included or how to select a list. Maybe you want to defend certain selections. Why not send me an email? Let me know what your favorites are, what books you hate, what books you think we've had enough of. I'd love to hear from you. Okay. Thanks again for listening. I'm Jack Wilson, and we'll see you next time.